Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jane Donahue. Today we take you to a talk at the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations with author and academic Matt Goodwin. The title of today's talk is Brexit, Trump, Le Pen, and the Rise of National Populism. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast.
Good afternoon to everyone and their guests who are here today, and also to those who are listening to us on the stations of Maine Public Radio. This is the 467th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. We come to you from the Elks Event Center in Rockland, Maine, and I'm George Look. The Midcoast Forum was founded over 40 years ago. Each month we hear an invited speaker on an issue related to U.S. foreign policy. You can listen to audios of past forum talks and get information about upcoming forum speakers on our website at midcoastforum.org. Recent forum talks are also available on the website of Maine Public Radio and on the website of the Maine Monitor. If you're interested in staying informed about key foreign affairs issues, please consider becoming a forum member. Our membership form is on the forum's website, and it's easy to apply. Our speaker today is Professor Matthew Goodwin, who will speak on Brexit, Trump, Le Pen, and the Rise of National Populism. Dr. Matt Goodwin is an academic, best-selling author, pollster, and speaker known for his research on politics, populism, elections, voting, public opinion, Brexit, Europe, and academic freedom, and even more than that. He is a professor of politics at the Rutherford College of Kent, of the University of Kent in London, and he recently served as senior visiting fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs at Chatham House, senior fellow with the UK in a changing Europe, senior fellow at the Legatum Institute, and senior advisor to the UK Education Committee. In 2002, Professor Goodwin was named a commissioner for the UK's Social Mobility Commission, which exists to create a United Kingdom where the circumstances of birth do not determine the outcomes of life. Professor Goodwin is the author of 6 books. The 2 most recent are the Sunday Times number 2 bestseller, Values, Voice, and Virtue, the New British Politics, and the Sunday Times bestseller, National Populism and the Revolt Against Liberal Democracy. This latter book was translated into multiple languages and listed among the Financial Times and the Times Literary Supplement's top book of the year. Professor Goodwin has published dozens of academic studies and research reports on European politics and populism. He regularly writes for and appears in international media, including the BBC News, Financial Times, New York Times, and Politico. He also shares his views on Substack at mattgoodwin.org, writing fortnightly newsletters and discussions with leading experts, thinkers, and writers.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Thank you, George, for that very, very kind introduction. How are we doing on level? Is that okay? And thank you all for giving up some of your day to be here listening to me. The journey over here was incredibly eventful. I flew into Boston and then assumed I'd be taking a normal plane up to Rockland. And I thought optimistically to myself, I'll have a nap on that plane. And then discovered that it was, in fact, an adventure involving only 7 of us. We were weighed before we got onto the plane. So thank you for that experience. It's a real treat. So as George mentioned, I'm here to talk about really the movement of our time, to talk about national populism and the way in which it's asserting itself onto our political systems. And I don't need to tell Americans of just how significant national populism is becoming. But what I do want to do in this talk, rather than go over everything that led up to the events of 2016 is really just try and make sense of where we are today and where I think we're going to be going over the next few years. Ever since those tumultuous events, firstly the vote for Brexit, which shocked us Brits, and then the vote for Trump a few months later, which I think shocked a lot of Americans, my friends at the Financial Times have written repeatedly that we have reached peak populism. For much of the last 8 years, every 6 months or so, Gideon Rachman or Robert Shrimsley or Janan Ganesh will write the column saying, this is it now, we've reached peak populism, everything's going back to normal. I'm here to tell you that is not going to happen, and I'm going to explain why I think we're living through a permanent adjustment in our political systems in the West. Many of the explanations that we've had for things like the rise of Trump, Marine Le Pen, Brexit, what we're seeing in Germany with the Alternative for Germany, many of those explanations I think have been comfort blankets for people of a more liberal outlook. We've been told a lot about things to do with misinformation, social media, Russia, tabloid newspapers. We've blamed everybody from Steve Bannon to Vladimir Putin to Dominic Cummings in Britain, the architect of the Brexit vote. And those things are important, but they're clearly not the whole story. We've also been told that in one way or another, demography is destiny. We had a lot of this after the vote for Brexit in Britain, where prominent columnists such as Polly Toynbee, among others, said that, well, the thing about Brexit is that most of the people who voted for it were retired, and how can I put this diplomatically, Brexit was probably not going to be an issue over the longer term. And many other writers in Europe have made similar arguments that essentially this is about angry old white men, essentially, is a narrative that you come across quite often in The Guardian or The Economist. It's not only about age, it's also about the way in which Western societies are rapidly diversifying. That because of migration, because of rapid cultural changes, the potential audience for movements that seek to prioritize the interests and the culture and the values of the majority group are going to struggle over the longer term to find new votes. So those are the arguments that have really been thrown around. But now I would encourage you just to look across Western democracies right now. I'm not an expert on American politics. I suspect lots of people in this room know a lot more about American politics than me, but when I glanced at the polling averages on Real Clear Politics last week preparing for this talk, I noticed that of the seven battleground states that will probably determine your US presidential election in November, Donald Trump was ahead in six of them, and in many of them was outside the margin of error. Certainly seemed to me, given that I was doing some polling in America in 2016, he certainly seems to be in a stronger position today than he was when he was first elected. Look across Europe. Next month, we have elections to the European Parliament. They're held every 5 years. They will determine who represents Europeans in the legislature. The only groups that are forecast to make gains are the conservative and reformist group, a sort of mainstream center-right group of parties, but also national populists in the Identity and Freedom Caucus, Marine Le Pen in France, the Alternative for Germany, Geert Wilders and the Party for Freedom in the Netherlands, also the Freedom Party in Austria, Viktor Orban's Fidesz movement in Hungary, Law and Justice in Poland, Vox in Spain, CEGA in Portugal, the Sweden Democrats, who announced their election campaign last week with the slogan, My Europe Builds Walls. What you're seeing, I would suggest, in the polling in Europe is the continued expansion of national populism as a political force. And we're seeing it too in Brexit Britain. One of the ironies of Brexit is that it's made our politics more European, in the sense that having left the European Union formally in 2020, we now have a Eurosceptic anti-immigration party picking up in the national opinion polls, called the Reform Party. It wants to reform Westminster, it wants to lower migration, it wants to fully disentangle Britain's institutions from our remaining links to the European Union, and only last week scored its best ever result at a parliamentary by-election, taking 17%. Most of its support is coming from disillusioned Conservatives, and it is almost certain to cause our Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, a major headache at the rapidly approaching general election. And here's the interesting thing about what's happening in Europe. Much of that support is actually not coming from middle-aged and older voters. Much of it's coming from the young. If you look at Germany, the alternative for Germany, according to a study that was released 2 weeks ago, is now taking 22% of all 18 to 30-year-olds in the country. And as I wrote on Substack when I summarized the evidence in other countries, in France, at the most recent presidential election, the under-35s were more likely than the over-35s to vote for Marine Le Pen. In fact, she won 44% of the under-35s. In the Netherlands, the young were far more likely to vote for Geert Wilders than the old. In Italy, Giorgia Meloni has emerged as the largest party among the under-35s, while almost half of young Italians voted for either Giorgia Meloni or Matteo Salvini's Lega movement. In Austria, the Freedom Party is back after a scandal, topping the polls with 30% support among younger voters. In Spain, Vox is attracting one in three under-35s, while in Sweden, the share of the very youngest voters who support the Sweden Democrats has doubled over the last 5 years to 22%, making them the second most popular party among first-time voters. The key point that I'm trying to make to folks who are attracted by the argument that demography is destiny is that none of this is going anywhere anytime soon. We also have a fascinating study in my field of political science, which came out recently, showing that for the first time, national populism is attracting significant support from minority voters in Europe and also young women. And the best conclusion that my colleagues in the Netherlands could draw from their findings is that those groups have one thing in common, which is that they are both increasingly anxious about the rise of Islam within Europe and immigration means for their hard-won rights, women's rights, and also the rights in particular for sexual minorities, LGBT people. So we're seeing something in the data that we haven't really seen before. Having looked at populism for quite a long time, I can tell you there's something very interesting going on in the water. And in America too, I don't need to tell you that obviously if the polling is correct at the moment, and we should always take midterm polling with a big pinch of salt, but if it is, and I suspect one reason why Donald Trump may find himself back in the White House is probably because of significant support among Latino and Hispanic voters, which if you look at the latest polling data seems to be up markedly from where it was both 4 years ago and 8 years ago. So why is all of this happening? It's happening because I think even now, 8 years on from 2016, we're still failing to get to grips with the drivers of national populism and, more importantly, respond to the reasons why people are so thoroughly alienated from mainstream politics and the dominant elite. And the way that I look at this is trying to take everything that we've been doing in social science and package it up in a way that can help us make sense of what is driving this considerable change in Western democracies. And I think really this comes down to four key drivers that we need to think much more seriously about. And I say that as somebody that
you know, I voted for Tony Blair earlier in my life. I have advised the Labour Party at different points in my life. I've certainly been going on a political journey over the last few years because, you know, I've, like many on the centre-left, historically, I've become very frustrated with the refusal of many of my friends and colleagues to actually address why people are so frustrated. So I can talk to you a bit later about that journey and how that's gone. The first thing I think we need to get serious about is just levels of distrust in the legacy institutions. If you look at all of the available data that we have at how people feel about established political institutions, and not just political institutions, but the creative industries, the cultural sector, higher education. I notice amid the protests that you're experiencing at the moment, Gallup have come out with data showing that public confidence in Ivy League universities in this country has never been as low as it is today, especially among Republicans. That public confidence and trust in higher education in the place that I work has never been as low. There are widespread feelings of distrust. We have this in the UK. Levels of trust in the BBC have taken a very sharp downturn. Flagship programs like Radio 4 Today, which some of the Brits in the room might still be listening to in the early hours of the morning. That's how everyone in Westminster starts their day. They lean over, they turn on the radio, and they listen to the dulcet tones of Nick Robinson telling you what's happening in Westminster. Well, they've lost 3 million listeners since Brexit, which is not a small figure. We've also seen the rise of new media, television channels like GB News, Talk TV. We're seeing the fragmentation of the cultural landscape. Why is this going on? I like to be challenging. I think it's going on because those institutions don't represent a lot of people. I think those institutions are overwhelmingly dominated by people who come from the same backgrounds, who've typically gone to the same universities, who typically hold the same cultural values. And I think what we have in many Western democracies is a crisis of representation. I think there are lots of voters looking at legacy institutions and saying to themselves, I don't see people like me in these institutions. I'm not part of this national conversation anymore. I feel as though I'm being talked down to rather than being invited into the conversation. There's a wonderful book, if you get a chance, called Diploma Democracies, which is by two academics in Europe, and they look at all the available data at who's representing people in the West political systems, and they find that overwhelmingly our political systems are dominated by a very narrow, highly educated, but also typically more socially liberal ruling class. And their argument in this book is actually, if you look at the policy outcomes that are coming through political systems in the West, those policy outcomes often reflect the values of that more dominant, socially liberal ruling class, but leave many other people feeling as though they're not really in the policy-making process. Now, they published that book just around the time of 2016, and if anything, I would argue that this challenge has become much more visible as institutions have doubled down on a minority, highly educated, but also in some ways quite homogenous elite. And again, being slightly provocative, it's also true that many members of that ruling class didn't always get things right. Enduring economic inequalities, pretty disastrous interventions in parts of the world like Iraq and Afghanistan, the legacy of globalization, a lot of economists that told us in the late 1990s that free trade and globalization would only be beneficial, would lift all boats, Tony Blair being one of them. Tony Blair in 2005 famously saying to British voters, if you question globalization, then you're close-minded. But we now know from a lot of evidence in economics, people like Daniel Dorn and David Auter and others, that actually globalization didn't work out as well as people hoped, that there were losers as well as winners, and that those losses were often concentrated among working class non-graduate voters in lots of areas I'm sure you're all familiar with in the United States, and I'm certainly familiar with in Northern England. And so I ask an open question, and I'll leave you pondering questions today, but could we make these institutions more representative of a wider range of voices in our society, non-graduates, cultural conservatives, people from working class backgrounds? Because when I look at these institutions, they are dominated by a fairly narrow ruling elite. And part of that elite too, looking at some research that's been done recently by groups like More in Common, and I'm a big fan of the More in Common think tank, if you get a chance to look at their work, they've done two seismic reports on the US and the UK, and they say, you know, one of the real problems going on in the West, and they're a pretty liberal centrist think tank, they say that's about 10 to 15% of our population now is not liberal, but is radically progressive, is what we might, I don't like the term, but we often refer to it as woke or liberalism or radical progressivism. And More in Common make the point that many of the people within the institutions now hold ideas on issues to do with gender, national identity, our history, which they view as fundamentally negative, and ultimately who we are. They hold views that are radically different from the average voter. And we've experienced this in the UK. If you're interested, a few weeks ago, we had a landmark review of what had been happening in the healthcare system, which was led by Dr. Hilary Cass. You might have read about this in the newspapers, CASS. And Dr. Hilary Cass looked at what had been happening across the healthcare sector to do with issues around gender identity and children transitioning and so on. And Dr. Cass made the very provocative, but I think necessary, point that much of what had been going on was actually not backed up by sufficient scientific evidence. And it was a reminder that, yes, we should try and restore confidence in the expert class, but there have been a number of cases where many of the people dominant in the institutions have actually been putting ideology ahead of evidence and ahead of scientific knowledge. And you know, we need to absorb these lessons and respond to them. I think secondly, there are a cluster of concerns alongside distrust over what people feel to be the destruction of their national culture, their ways of life, the things that make them who they are. If you look at all of the available evidence that we have on national populism, consistently the biggest driver of support is public concern over immigration and rapid demographic change. Border security, the scale of churn that's now taking place in Western societies and how they're being transformed by this change. In the UK, for example, the top issue for all Conservative voters right now, which is why I suspect the Conservatives will lose the election later this year, is the arrival of people on small boats who are getting into these dinghies in France, and they're crossing the Channel, which is the busiest shipping lane in I think, the West, and some of whom tragically are losing their lives. And we've had about 120,000 people entering Britain over the last 5 years, which has been generating considerable concern. Now, if you're a Brexit voter and you were promised control, much of this is really symbolic of the way in which you do not have much control over who is coming in and out of your country. Boris Johnson, who I briefed twice, Boris Johnson, the famous joke being that Boris Johnson was the third prime minister to be brought down by Boris Johnson, given that he successfully dispatched David Cameron, Theresa May, and then himself through his own incompetence. But nonetheless, Boris Johnson promised the British people lower migration and control of their borders. And then when he became prime minister, we saw a complete reconfiguration of our migration policy, making it less dependent upon Europe and much more open to other areas of the world, to India, Nigeria, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and beyond. And for many voters, this has proven to be deeply alarming because, to be blunt, they were misled by parts of our political class, and the number one reason now why many of those voters are saying they're not going to engage in politics at all is because they feel deeply alarmed over the pace of migration and demographic change that they are now experiencing. And this is taking place across Europe, where the refugee crisis that we're witnessing, particularly in Italy, in France and elsewhere, has not yet been resolved. We have no meaningful response to voters who are saying in Germany, in Hungary, and in Italy, can you please regain control of the borders? And I don't need to tell Americans what a salient issue this is becoming for voters. I imagine here this is probably the number one issue for Republicans, were I to look at the data. And in the same way, I think it's also an enormous issue in parts of Europe. Alongside these fears of ways of life and the way in which people's identities and they feel their identities are being broken down, are parallel concerns over relative deprivation, which has been making a comeback in social science, a sense that compared to other groups, my group is losing out. Peter Hall at Harvard has a fascinating study on national populism in which he shows conclusively that many of the people who are being drawn into these movements are not always objectively economically deprived, but they do share a sense of relative deprivation, a subjective sense of deprivation that compared to other groups in society, my group is somehow being left behind culturally, demographically, and also economically. And I would argue that this sense of loss, this sense of cultural loss, is unhelpfully being exacerbated by that minority progressive elite. I've just finished reading Yasha Munk's book, The Identity Trap. Yasha, you may know, he writes for The Atlantic. He's advised Tony Blair, Barack Obama, among others. He's a very reasonable writer who I think would put himself on the center left. But in The Identity Trap, Yasha says, you know, one of the problems we now have in the universities, in the media, and many other institutions is exactly this trap, that many well-intentioned, well-meaning, liberal-minded folks who are trying to make the world a better place have also perhaps lost sight of the fact that the ideology that is becoming entrenched in many of these institutions isn't liberal at all. It is fundamentally illiberal because it is prioritizing fixed group identities above our individual rights. It actually doesn't really have much interest in who we are as individuals. It's merely interested in who we are in terms of our group identity, our racial, sexual, or gender identity. And it is reconstructing our society around a very simplistic binary divide between the virtuous, the morally superior, victimized minorities, and the morally inferior, oppressive majority. And I can see this in my university, but we also now see it in lots of high schools in Britain, and we see it in parts of the media. If you're concerned that your group is being left behind, then you are going to be especially concerned by a narrative that says you should also be ashamed of who you are. And this is where I think progressives and liberals are making life harder for themselves. The most compelling response to national populism, surely, is to reassert a cohesive, unifying story of who we are, not to break us down into competing tribes, battling it out for resources, battling it out for recognition. We also need to be sensitive to the fact that our national identities have a great deal of meaning and are a great source of status for many voters, especially working class voters, especially non-graduate voters. For example, in Britain and much of Europe, we do see quite a continual push by members of the ruling class to reshape national identities around universal liberal themes, around a celebration of diversity, around a celebration of multiculturalism, around a celebration of migration. In America, obviously, given your national history, it's slightly different. You are a nation of immigration, so it's a somewhat different story. But as Francis Fukuyama points out in his book Identity, which is a fascinating book, and I'd recommend it, he says to say that a nation is welcoming of diversity is fine. It's a laudable goal. But if the only thing that defines you is your celebration of diversity, then it's also like saying you don't really have an identity of your own. And many voters, I think, instinctively pick up on that and feel as though their distinctive sense of identity, their distinctive sense of history and culture is being eroded on the altar of universal liberal themes. John Curtis, a professor of political science in the UK, who's probably the leading cephologist, the leading academic on elections, he ran one of the largest studies of the Brexit vote, and he found the strongest driver was a concern among Brexit voters that they were losing their distinctive sense of identity, that they were losing their sense of who they were, who they are, as a consequence of some of these changes. So my question, again, to leave it hanging over the room, is how can we construct a better story of who we are, one that's both responsible but also cognizant of the fact that people do not want to lose that distinctive story of their history, their culture, and their values. And lastly, if you look at my field of political science, there is now a widespread consensus that Western democracies are not going back into what we called the golden age of democracy in the post-war years. The golden age being a time when people had very strong tribal allegiances to the big parties, when their parents voted for the Democrats and their parents voted for the Democrats, or my dad voted for Labour and his dad voted for Labour, and politics was stable and it was fairly secure and it was fairly cohesive. That era of alignment has now fully come to an end. In fact, among most political scientists, there's a consensus we are fully in the era of de-alignment, where voters are now picking parties in a much more fluid way, a bit like they pick groceries at the superstore. And I think if you just take a step back and look at the bigger picture, you know, I do remind my students of this, we've really only had mass representative democracy for 100 years or so. And not even that, when you consider voting rights for women, for minorities. Mass representative democracy is still a very young experiment. Yes, its ideas can be traced back to ancient Greece, but this is still a young experiment that we are embarking upon. But already we can see how those big parties that were rooted in the Industrial Revolution, that were rooted in the late 19th century, the 18th century, are really struggling now to sustain the loyalty of today's voters. To give you one statistic from the UK, over the last 10 years, 60% of all voters, 6-0, changed their vote from one party to another, which we've never seen before, that level of volatility in the system. You have more independent voters than you have before. Over 70% of Americans, I read, say they don't want either Trump or Biden, ideally, to run. So politics in the West overall is becoming much more chaotic, much more unpredictable, which is why if you're Marine Le Pen in France, or you're Giorgia Meloni in Italy, or you're the Sweden Democrats, it's becoming a lot easier to break through into the system. If you're meeting voters on these issues around their lack of trust in institutions, their sense of concern over ways of life being destroyed, this parallel worry about their group being left behind relative to others, it's a lot easier for these parties to break through much more quickly and in a much more significant way. So what do we do about it? And how do we respond to national populism? I think if you take everything that I've said, you have a view that I think so far the response to this movement has been woefully inadequate over the last 8 years. There has been a refusal to deal seriously with the reasons why so many voters are alienated from our politics. And I think, obviously, that's because people's knee-jerk reaction is to say, well, that means you want to do what the populists want to do. And that's not what I'm advocating for a second. What I'm saying, firstly, is if we want to respond to this movement and ensure that it doesn't continue to get bigger and bigger, as we're seeing from one set of elections to another over the longer term, we need to make our institutions more representative. We need to have a wider range of voices in everything from universities, where I've looked at the ratio of Republican-registered academics to Democrat-registered academics. My friend Neil Ferguson, a historian, has tracked this in detail, showing that in some departments in the US, the ratio is about 30 to 1. So for every 30 Democrat-registered academics, you have one Republican. So how are students getting exposed to the wide range of views and beliefs that exist in wider society? And that's just universities. How do we make media more representative? How do we make the political institutions more representative? How do we revitalize democracy locally and regionally so people feel as though they have a voice in the national conversation in a way that is much more responsible and convincing? I think also we need to strike a compromise on the issue of immigration. This is where I lose some of my friends on the center-left in Britain. I think if we don't begin to lower the speed and scale of migration and demographic change, we are going to see considerable political unrest in the future. I'll give you just one stat from Britain, for those of you who have an interest. Between today and 2036, so between my daughter being 2 and 14, which is not a long time at all, the government's own forecasts in Britain say that we'll have 6.5 million more people entering into Britain than we have now, which is 70% of London. Now, we already have a housing crisis, so I'm not entirely sure how we're going to accommodate that kind of change. But somehow, Western nations are going to have to think much more seriously about how they can navigate these changes while keeping voters on board. Justin Trudeau in Canada has just recently come out and said he accepts Canada has entered into what we call a population trap, where the capacity of the state to provide basic public services is now being exceeded by the pace of population change. And this is an unsustainable situation for Western countries to be. It's a controversial and it's a difficult thing to talk about. But I think unless we reach some kind of compromise on the migration issue, from your southern border to our growing crisis in the Channel, where only last week, tragically, a 7-year-old girl who was on the small boats lost her life. You know, we don't want to see this happening. We're going to have to completely reset the legal architecture and public policies to try and ensure that this doesn't happen anymore. And lastly, I think moderate, sensible, responsible liberals have to start speaking up against radical progressives who are pushing ideas that are alienating a large number of voters. And again, this is a difficult thing for many people on the left to talk about, especially in universities where I work. But I think the evidence on this is quite clear. One of the reasons why Hispanic and Latino voters in America are moving from left to right, if you look at some of the studies that have been done recently, is partly because of their concerns over some of the more radical policies that have been advocated on the left, like policies such as defund the police, those sorts of ideas. But if you also look at what's happening in Europe and the reaction against the ruling class, particularly among voters who are deeply concerned about some of the proposals on gender identity, for example, or how we think about our history, this is now having a very meaningful impact on real-world elections. Some of you might have been to Scotland. I'll give you an example. When Nicola Sturgeon and the Scottish National Party proposed that 16-year-olds be allowed to legally change their gender without medical supervision, only 20% of Scots agreed with that policy. This was part of Nicola Sturgeon's downfall and is also now one of the reasons why Scotland will not be voting for independence anytime soon because of the SNP's weakness. But I think there has to be a greater sense of confidence among people in the middle ground, in the center, to try and take on and moderate some of the proposals that are coming from the left of politics, which are clearly alienating many voters. We see that in perceptions of our national history as well. Many voters in Britain instinctively reject the assumption that Britain as a society is institutionally racist, that the legacy of empire was negative. They're very concerned about what children are being taught in this area. And there are many people on the right who have actively weaponized these issues in an irresponsible way. But it's also true that how we think about our history and our identity and our culture, who we are, is also foundational to our civilization. It's an existential question. And many voters care deeply about that. So I would like to see us trying to do more from the middle ground, from the moderate middle, in taking on the extremes. Because if we don't, I fear that not only will I be back in Camden in 5 years or 10 years telling you about how populism has reached another new high, but I'll also be on one of those bloody aeroplanes risking my life thinking to myself, George, next time I need a car. I can't do it again. But thank you for listening. I hope some of what I've said resonates. It's been deliberately challenging and provocative because I am deeply concerned about the direction of travel, and I do think it's on a lot of us in this room who would describe ourselves as responsible Democrats and concerned citizens to just ask ourselves, have we actually got everything right here? Or is there more that we can do in the short term in terms of striking a compromise in order to win the longer term battle? But thank you for your time. Thank you for listening. I look forward to lunch.
Matt, you have to answer questions.
Oh, sorry.
We're not letting you off yet.
Singing for myself.
My goodness. Sorry. Not so fast. Sorry. I'm sure there'll be a lot of questions. They've given us an awful lot to think about. I was asked the first question, and I guess I wanted to ask you if you'd make some comments on what these populist movements mean for international affairs. I know in the U.S., the populist movement is very isolationist, which has a real implication for international affairs. What's your view? How do you see that?
So one of the interesting characteristics, particularly in Europe, obviously in America, I imagine, were things to happen in November that I talked about, you'd have a radically different stance on Ukraine and most likely also Israel. In Europe, firstly, there's a lot of division within the National Populist Party family. So there are some who are much closer to Russia than others. Marine Le Pen has, and her family or party, have famously taken funding from Russia. Parties in Italy are fairly close. In the same way to Russia, are very hawkish on isolationist, I should say, on things like Ukraine. They don't want to keep spending money on a campaign that they think ultimately is not going to be successful. They're also very supportive of restraining the power of the European Union. One interesting thing that happened after Brexit is that very few parties in Europe followed the Brexiteers by saying they wanted to leave the European Union altogether. Instead, what they tend to say now is they want to reform the European Union and make it a union of nation states rather than a centralized bloc. So there'll be a growing push within the European Union to cede power down to nation states. There'll be growing hostility to our continued involvement in Ukraine. And also regarding Israel and Gaza, many of these parties are instinctively on the side of Israel. Geert Wilders is perhaps the most prominent example, not simply through the view of having a loyalty to Israel, which Geert Wilders certainly does, but more because of their concern about the rise of radical Islamism within European societies and their view that what happens in and around Israel is deeply consequential for the future of Europe. And these are debates that are now bleeding into British politics, as you might have seen over the last week, where we now have a lot of local level councillors campaigning on the issue of Gaza. And of course, you've seen this in your universities. So I think there will be considerable change. But after next month, the key point is you're going to see more pressure on the European Union to solve the refugee crisis, to push power down rather than hoarding it at the centre, and to give more influence to voters. I'm also looking at just how many questions you have there, George.
Yeah.
And I'm beginning to think, are we having lunch or dinner?
I think so. So am I. But I can start to see a theme here on some of them.
Okay.
And I've just grabbed three, but I think there are probably a lot more in these pieces. And it's all the same kind of general. Does national populism always lead to authoritarian government? I mean, are those one and the same? It seems to be that authoritarianism evolves from populism.
Well, I think it's important to firstly just remind ourselves why populists are different from Democrats. I mean, Democrats subscribe to a liberal conception of democracy that is about individual rights and the rule of law. Populists typically subscribe to a direct conception of democracy, which is about rule by majority will, which is about asserting the majority view above and beyond minorities, which is why populism is problematic and can slide into authoritarianism. Margaret Canavan, if you're interested, you'll be able to find her essay online in a piece called The Two Faces of Populism, argued that you can never get rid of this movement because it is rooted in that direct conception of democracy that we can trace back to Greece. You know, that essentially populism, in her words, is the shadow that follows democracy because it thrives off the tension between majority will on one side and technocracy or rule by bureaucrats on the other. And so when technocracy goes too far, think, for example, about the European Union or perhaps some of the reaction to the pandemic, when citizens become instinctively nervous about a concentration of power in bureaucracy, which can be very dry, can be very managerial, can be very detached from ordinary people, her argument was that the politics of faith will reassert itself, the politics of emotion, the politics of ideology, the politics of the masses, of passion. And so Canavan famously described populism as existing, you know, in a seesaw fashion. So it's a very distinctive view. She says it's a corrective, however odd that may sound, but when populists are successful, they're also partly correcting the system. They're reminding the people running the system that they have lost touch on some of those key issues. Now, obviously, you know, there are movements that then slide into open authoritarianism and illiberalism that then breach the boundaries of democracy. But I don't think that's always the case. I think if you look at, say, somebody like Giorgia Meloni, the fear going into the Meloni administration was that she would be authoritarian. What we've seen in the aftermath of her election is a softening of her position on a range of issues. Donald Trump, if he were returned to the White House, I suspect we'd see a very different reaction among Donald Trump. So I think it varies from place to place, but it's worth coming back to this point that this is ultimately about competing conceptions of democracy and where power lies within democracy.
Thank you. There's a number of questions here related to what you've said about education in the colleges. One here which really struck me was many elite universities became more homogenous in terms of their students in the last 20 years. And if the student body is much more culturally diverse, why hasn't this made a difference in the professors, the faculty?
So it's a fascinating question. I'm writing a book on this at the moment. So I think if you look at what's been happening since the 1960s, essentially, is that the universities, the universities in the post-war period have always leaned a bit more to the left. But if you take Britain as an example, the ratio in the 1960s was typically 3-1. So for every left-leaning professor, for every 3 left-leaning professors, you got 1 conservative-leaning professor. That ratio today is about 10-1. So if you supported Brexit in universities, for example, you know, that was about a 10% position. Now, of course, it wasn't always that way. Julian Bender, some of you will have read The Treason of the Intellectuals, which was published in 1930-something or other. He made the point then that actually the real problem with the intellectual class was that they were justifying fascism, that in Germany and elsewhere they were laying a foundation for what Hitler and the Nazis would then use, sort of legitimizing anti-Semitism and expansionary foreign policy and so on. Today, some of my colleagues, Neil Ferguson among others, would argue that the academy has moved so far left that they are now justifying a different form of extremism in the sense of anti-Semitism and support for Hamas on campus. And I've been deeply appalled by the reaction of some of our universities to October 7th. Jonathan Haidt, who I'm sure you will know, who wrote The Coddling of the American Mind, has been pointing to the events on campus recently and saying this is exactly what happens when you allow a very divisive brand of identity politics to flourish on campus without consequence. that students are actively encouraged to view the world in a very simplistic, binary way, where all minorities are good, and the majority, including, by the way, Jews, are bad. And this is a deeply problematic state of affairs, which is why in the UK we campaigned for something called the Higher Education Free Speech Act, which now has created a legal duty on universities and colleges to promote free speech and free expression on campus. Many of us were deeply reluctant to use the state to intervene in higher education, a bit like some of your politicians in places here in the US have done. But the reality, and I say this as somebody that's worked in universities for over 20 years, the reality is that the universities were not reforming themselves. So what you would see were unorthodox, contrarian professors being sacked and harassed on campus because they questioned things that, you know, from identity politics through to gender ideology and whatever, and they were being, you know, losing their jobs. So we need much greater viewpoint diversity on campus. We have to get different perspectives onto campus in order, firstly, to show students that those perspectives exist, but also to get back to what universities are supposed to be about, which is the search for truth, search for reason, prioritizing evidence over ideology, not prioritizing ideology over evidence, and ensuring that meritocracy, rather than identity, is how children and students make it into higher education.
This one's not exactly related to that, but how do we encourage more representation of less educated individuals in politics or university or places when or if education is important to these processes?
Well, there are different, I would answer that by saying there are different forms of education. I mean, I think, if you take Western Europe as an example, there is now a consensus that we simply have too many people going to university. One in three university degree holders in Britain are working in jobs that do not require a university degree. At the same time, we have a lack of people with technical and vocational qualifications that are needed to revitalize our industrial base and are needed to contribute to other aspects of the economy. So this is part of what our post-Brexit strategy of leveling up was supposed to be about, which was investing in children and adults who want to pursue different types of skills within the education system. Simply sending people into university, as Michael Sandel and others have argued here in the US, is not the answer. We have to rethink how we do things. And if you take media as an example, well, one of the realities of where I live is that the chances of somebody who did not go to Oxbridge, Oxford or Cambridge, making it into national media today are almost minimal. Local media has collapsed, regional media has collapsed. If you want an internship to go and work at the Times of London, you will need accommodation in London, you will need somebody to bankroll you, which then really limits the intake to more privileged, affluent families. We simply don't have the ladders that used to be there through things like trade unions, local institutions, to get a wider range of voices into the national conversation, say into the BBC. And often the diversity metric is used to conceal that lack of ideological diversity. So we've just had a very vigorous debate about the lack of gender diversity in the BBC, but the real lack of diversity is actually around class. It's around class and education. So, you know, we need alternative perspectives, and this is also true of things like the publishing industry, the creative industries, which is forcing open a much wider, more meaningful conversation in the country. So I'd start looking at those ladders and where they were and why they're not there now and how we can rebuild some of them.
So one thing you haven't really discussed is the role of religion is playing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know what a big role it plays in the U.S., but in the U.S., religion is playing a major role, yeah, in right-wing politics. What role do you think it,
yeah,
has
obviously
been?
It's a lot bigger here than it is, you know, from the little island that I'm from. I'll give you a little stat that is quite striking. If you look at baby boomers in Britain, about one-third of them identify with the Church of England. which also shows the decline of religiosity over the post-war period. But if you look at my Gen Z students who were born in the late 1990s and the early 2000s, 1% identify with the Church of England. 1%, according to the British Social Attitude Survey. So religiosity, obviously, it's a different story in Italy and Spain, where you have a much richer legacy and tradition of religion. But there too, you know, most of the studies, we can see the weakening of those anchors rooted in religion. We can also see the rise of things like family breakdown, much higher rates of divorce, lower birth rates. The Lancet published a study 2 weeks ago which showed that by the year 2100, the birth rates of most European nations will be around 1.3, the replacement rate being about 2.1. We're seeing the traditional anchors that gave people meaning and solidarity and a feeling of belonging, family, religion, I would also argue nation, which is why I keep coming back to this view of national identity as being a sort of source of shame and embarrassment. For many people, it's an incredibly important feeling of belonging. As those anchors give way, it's going to be much more difficult to carry people with us, to give people a shared story of who we are. And if the only thing that's going to fill that void is a more divisive, a corrosive belief system that pits us against one another based on our identity, I really become quite deeply concerned about the direction of travel over the longer term. So religion, obviously, very much more important here and in some European countries, but overall, I think you look at the longer term trend, I don't think we can count on a revival to get us out of the woods.
I wish we had time to do the other 362 questions here, but I don't think we do. So I just wanted to thank you very much.
Well, thank you for your time.
It's been very useful.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program featured a discussion hosted by the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations with author and academic Matt Goodwin. If you missed part of the program or want to listen again, you can also find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is produced by me, Jane Donahue. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.